And welcome back to the Spartan History Podcast. This is episode 22, Raising Spartans. The children now love luxury. They've had bad manners, contempt for authority. They show disrespect for elders and love chatter in place of exercise. Children are now tyrants, not the servants of their households. They no longer rise when elders enter the room. They contradict their parents, chatter before company, gobble up dainties at the table, cross their legs, and tyrannise their teachers. These words sound so similar to the ones I heard as a child, as the people a generation or two before my own bemoaned the wayward youth of the day and the perilousness the future held as the world was left to the mercy of my often sticky fingers and grimy face. They were, however, the utterances of Socrates, as recorded by Plato in the 4th century. Incredibly relevant 2.5 millennia later, the venerable philosopher was certainly referring to the spoiled youth of Athens, who no doubt spurned his wisdom and made fun of his unkempt hair. Perhaps the same youth, whom he was eventually accused of corrupting by the city's unruly democracy and consigned to drink hemlock in a ritualised, state-ordained suicide. Had Socrates visited Sparta, he'd have found cause for hope in that place's offspring, for there, discipline and obedience reigned supreme, and were enforced enthusiastically by the city's inhabitants and their traditions. It's fitting to start this episode of Spartan History Podcast with a quote from an Athenian, for I intend to use that city and its own pedagogical practices as a counterposition for Sparta's own. Alone, the raising of Spartan youth seems archaic and strange, but using the Athenian model for context, it'll help us understand how truly alien and unique it was in the ancient Greek world. For better or for worse, a record of Athena's city is the most complete description we have of a polis from that time, with Sparta coming in at a distant second. Doing that, we'll be able to truly contrast what little we know about them with comparatively rock-solid Athenian accounts. Unfortunately, this episode will be loaded with essential anachronisms due to our source material. Most of the homogenisation and cultural normativism crystallised during the 7th century as a reaction to the so-called Helot threat within Sparta. However, our first true sources come in the 5th and 4th centuries to the likes of Herodotus and Xenophon, both non-Spartan authors, though the latter in particular is highly relevant having lived in Laconia. In that vein, I want to establish from the outset that although our references aren't necessarily contemporary with the beginning of the state-sponsored education programs, there was certainly a witness to those methods in their maturity. Now, I've wrestled for many months with how to tackle this episode, and have come to the decision to not pull any punches. I pray to you, my dear listeners, that we can accept the subject material for what it is, a historical account. What I say here today has no bearing on any of my personal beliefs, nor what I see as relevant to the modern era. When studying history, we should abandon any ideologies, prejudices, or highfalutin principles we might have and appreciate that time is a mercurial thing, and who knows how or for what posterity might judge us too. We rob out the unsavoury parts of history at our own peril, for history is first and foremost a lesson to us now, and should be observed with an equal measure of its glory and infamy. Homosexuality, misogyny, child abuse, and paederasty are all topics that have a strong bearing on any discussion around Spartan and Athenian culture. Leaving any of these subjects out in the hope of not offending anyone would be possible, but would leave us with a mere fraction of the story. Now, I don't like leaving any stone unturned, as most of you will by now be aware, so deal with them, we will. Homosexuality is a relatively modern term, and the increasing acceptance of its part in our world is, too, a relatively modern thing and something to be esteemed. The ancient Greeks had no word for it specifically, and we need to be careful in how we interpret their practices. It was extremely common in ancient Greece, and same-sex affection carried none of the stigma that is all too often attached to it today. Indeed, the overwhelming perception of Greek men in that time was one of male superiority, with women being, in a sense, not wholly human and therefore not worthy or even capable of true love. It was an ideal of men to attach themselves to other men they respected, be it academically or militaristically, so that as a partnership they might shine. These bonds often, but not always, involve sex. As I hinted at, it led directly into the misogynistic element of society. Women had no overt place politically within the Greek governmental sphere and almost no rights to speak of. They were simply broodmares at worst and chattel slaves at best, wholly under the dominion of their menfolk. There was a deep-seated fear within the minds of Greek men that women would corrupt, coerce, or control them unduly and in turn needed to be suppressed. This terror is personified by the mythological Amazonians, who, although independent, had the good grace to live apart from men, mind their own business, and only cohabit for the purposes of procreation. In reality, this is how the classical Athenian preferred his woman. We'll see that even subjected by the males of Sparta as they were, the women of that city were quite the anomaly by the standards of the time. So much so that Aristotle lays the fall of Sparta squarely at the sandaled feet of its wives. As a father, I struggle with the often brutal, corporal, and well-documented punishment inflicted on the Spartan children. My son, Leonidas, carries a name from that city, but that will be the extent of their culture that I'll subject him to. No doubt, as he grows, he might consider that name punishment enough, but I hope not. That being said, Spartan violence towards their children was rarely extrajudicial. Obedience was central to their philosophy and the great prize of full enfranchisement its ultimate goal. The stakes were high, and the punishments in accordance. The idea of reasoning with children, or removing them from situations rather than physically disciplining them, is a relatively new thing. It was not uncommon in my own upbringing to feel the sting of leather on my backside, or the wooden spoon which seemed to be a favourite in my household. I, however, had a roof over my head, clothing with which to warm me, and sufficient amounts of food, and in comparison to some parts of the world, had a considerably fortunate upbringing. Spartan boys had none of those things, and lived in perpetual fear of disciplinary measures should they fall short in any of their many tasks set before them. Finally, paederasty, which is often conflated or confused with pedophilia. By modern standards, the difference could easily be written off as splitting hairs, but it's heavily nuanced and needs to be teased apart. The pernicious practice of child sexual abuse isn't bounded by error and has assuredly been perpetrated since the dawn of time. The Catholic Church has been thoroughly riven by its stain in recent times, but its disgusting practice has polluted all the world at one time or another. Paedophilia was abhorrent, even to the ancient Greeks, although at the same time they practiced paederasty. The difference is one of simply assuaging base physical urges through the infliction of sexual abuse, whether unsanctioned or sometimes in a nauseatingly sanctioned act. The other had at its heart higher ideals of education and incorporation within society, and while sex was a part of this practice, it was a tertiary concern at best. Personally, I struggle to put this part of history in its proper place, but it is what it is, and we'll disambiguate it better during the episode. Okay, with that extended disclaimer out of the way, let's move forward with the raising of our Spartans. The last of Rome's five good emperors, Marcus Aurelius, recorded the following saying in a work now known as the Meditations. As you kiss your son goodnight, whisper to yourself, he may be dead in the morning. Marcus knew this well for himself. Out of 13 children he and his wife Faustina had, only 6 saw their 10th birthday. An unfortunate state of affairs for any parent, but worse still for Rome, in that one of the survivors was Commodus. It is believed that in the ancient world, regardless of location, 1 out of every 4 children died before their first year of life had transpired. Incredibly harsh times, and the joy with which most births are greeted in this day and age would have been laced with a fair amount of trepidation for the prospective parents in the past. For mother and baby, childbirth too was an extremely hazardous procedure. Stoicism aside, the Spartans, unencumbered as they were from any real privation due to their enslaved caste of helots, had every opportunity to raise their children in the lap of relative luxury. However, due to necessity, they chose an entirely different path for the youth of the city. Outnumbered by their so-called lesser subjects, they were the privileged and precious few, and could ill afford to lose a single soul. But if they were to remain the dominant power in Laconia and neighbouring Messenia, only the right type of citizen would do. The hard-fought victory in the Second Messenian War proved that. So rather than wrap their children in cotton wool, they doubled down on fate and set before their young a series of challenges that needed to be overcome in order to achieve acceptance and full enfranchisement within Spartan society. It would be, quite possibly, the toughest state-sponsored regime ever conceived to raise children, with failure at any stage resulting in near permanent ostracism from the citizen body, or worse still, death. It isn't precisely known when the Spartans began this program of indoctrination, but most consider it a likely consequence of the pressures placed upon the state by the aforementioned Messenian War. Some scholars point to its origin in the early 10th century Dorian migration, though the Argives and Messenians, who were of similar extraction, have no record of anything remotely like it. Either way, the picture we get in the late 5th and early 4th centuries is of a regimented, compulsory, and grueling upbringing of children. I place the terminus for such a revolution at around the 600 BCE mark, perhaps not fully fledged by that time, but well on its way nonetheless. A study of women, and more specifically girls, is an often futile pursuit when it comes to the ancient Greeks. Due to the extreme levels of misogyny, even the odd account that we do have is heavily polluted by the prejudices of men in the time. Sparta, as in a great many other things, is in this regard particularly unique. Their women were not only visible, they had a voice and were not afraid to use it. That's not to say we have a wealth of information regarding the upbringing of girls, we don't. But at the very least, we can paint a brief narrative. Something that would be very difficult to do with any degree of accuracy for the girls of other city-states. Like most things to do with the Lacedaemonians, there are two sides to this story, and we'll need to look at both to see how great the dichotomy is. First, there is the Athenian view, which will serve as the external impression more generally. Spartan women were a favourite trope used by the great playwrights of Athens, who lampooned them to prove their apparent degenerate nature. Compared to their own cloistered and repressed women, the men of Athens had much to fear from the seemingly liberated wives of Sparta. For contrast, let's first look at how those Athenians viewed their own wives and daughters. Modesty, chastity, and most importantly, invisibility, were the things most expected from them. After some early reversals during the beginning of the Peloponnesian War, Pericles, the most powerful voice in the Athenian democracy, gave a funeral oration exhorting his people to take heart from their privileged position as the shining light of Greek culture. Right at the end of his 15-minute speech, he turns briefly to address the widows and women more broadly when he says, "The greatest glory will be hers who is least talked of among men, whether for good or bad." Add to that the opinion that an Athenian woman's world stopped at the boundary of her house, and you can see that the preference was for females to be not only unheard, but also unseen in public. This is typified by the theatre, where all female parts were performed by males, often boys. The hetaira, a type of courtesan, was the exception to the rule in this instance with their appearance in many ancient Athenian works of literature, but of the wives themselves, we hear very little indeed. In opposition, we need only turn to the stage to see what regards the women of Sparta were held within Athens. Euripides released his Andromache during the Peloponnesian War. Although ostensibly dealing with Bronze Age legends, the role of Menelaus is seen as a characterization of contemporary Athenian opinions of their enemies. The Spartan king is portrayed as an arrogant butcher, but a bully at heart, a coward. Pertinent to our topic is a scene involving the father of Achilles, Peleus, who gives Menelaus an almighty dressing down in one of the truly most memorable Euripidean solos. At one point in it, he turns his acerbic tongue on the morals of the Spartan women when he says, "No Spartan girl could ever grow up to be modest, even if she wanted to. You never find them staying at home. No, they go out with bare thighs and loose clothes to wrestle and run races along with the young men. I find it intolerable." Utterly scandalous from the perspective of a late 5th century Athenian like Euripides, and the great playwright was indeed referring to girls living in his own time by the Eurotas and not during the mythic age. Ironically, if a Spartan man ever heard the Andromache, he would have nodded his approval at such activities in his womenfolk. Another, and perhaps the most famous example of Sparta's apparently garrulous women comes from a comedy by Aristophanes called the Lysistrata. Named after the eponymous, though fictitious Athenian woman who attempted to end the Peloponnesian War by instituting a sex strike against the combatants, thus forcing them to negotiate peace. She gathers others of a similar mindset together and begins to formulate her plan when a Spartan woman, Lampito, enters the scene having travelled from far off Laconia to Athens. The newcomer is greeted in the following way by the play's central protagonist. "Good day, Lampito, dear friend from Lacedaemon. How well and handsome you look. What a rosy complexion. And how strong you seem. Why, you could surely strangle a bull." To this Lampito replies, "Yes, indeed, I really think I could. 'Tis because I do gymnastics and practice heel to buttock jumps." Lysistrata continues, "And my, what a perfect set of breasts you have." Momentarily indignant, Lampito finishes with, "Ah! You are feeling me as if I were a beast for sacrifice." The Athenian, male audience, in between hoots of laughter, could hardly miss the obvious difference between their own wives, who were safely barred within the home, and the apparent freedom of their Spartan opposites. The mere fact that Aristophanes represents such a woman having left Sparta for Athens in the first place is reason enough for surprise. It would have been a rare thing indeed for a female to be so mobile in the Greek world. Not only that, much is made of Lampido's strong figure and firm breasts, the first, the result of physical education, and the second, a benefit of using perhaps helot wet nurses. Once again, what seemed to have been scandalous within Athens was largely approved of and appropriate for the Spartans. Lampido is simply an embodiment of the ethnic stereotype that assuredly played across the imaginations of the Athenian populace at large. The impression you get, albeit Athena-centric, is one of a highly liberated female society within Sparta, something to be esteemed in this day and age, but it wasn't so to contemporary external observers, who considered them licentious and immoral. Aristotle wrote that Lycurgus regulated the excesses of the men within Laconia, bringing a veneer of morality and equality to the city. His wisdom, however, did not extend to the women, who, according to Aristotle at least, lived in every sort of intemperance and wealth. We'll see that Athenian perceptions were not necessarily incorrect. It was merely their misogyny that skewed them into something negative. That the majority of our sources are Athenian should in no way detract from the fact that those views would have been shared by the other city-states of which we have little record for. As will become apparent, it was the Spartan state and its particular idiosyncrasies that led both to the most feared warriors and the most precocious mothers of warriors Greece had ever or would ever see. So let's head to the banks of the Eurotas for the story of those women's upbringing, for it was here, in the shadow of Taygetus, that the only Greek state to ever institutionalise childhood education existed. And it was an extended process in Sparta as opposed to Athens, especially for the girls. In Athens, girls were married off, often to a far older man at an age between 12 and 14, whereas their Spartan contemporaries were generally expected to marry at 18 and to men of similar ages. In Laconia, it's quite likely the two newlyweds participated in events throughout their upbringing and would have hardly been unknown to one another, given the commune lifestyle of Sparta. In order to perpetuate itself, Sparta required two things at the most fundamental level: warriors and mothers. The curriculum was therefore divided by sex, but equally compulsory and consistent in its individual application. There is little thought given to it in all the literature I've come across, but I believe the feminine side to have been as competitive as what we'll later see from the masculine side. Simply being born a legitimate girl of a Spartiate couple didn't necessarily guarantee you a seat in the class of the ruling homoioi. Indeed, only men could gain citizenship in Greece, and in Sparta, it was a hard-earned privilege and never a right. The right kind of birth could afford an individual the opportunity to compete for citizenship, but only that. And its competitiveness that lied at the heart of the Laconian system, designed to make its participants strive to be the best of the best. Ostensibly, only the most capable woman would have the opportunity to marry Greece's finest warriors and perpetuate the next generation. I propose that should a girl not grow to be married off to a Spartan soldier, then she would join the class of inferiors, or hippomionis as they were called, a subcaste that dwelt somewhere between the homoioi and the perioikoi in social standing. Therefore, her training and testing was crucial to ensure her acceptance within the full enfranchisement, as it were, for a non-voting woman of Sparta. The gaining of literacy is the first thing that set the girls here apart. There is evidence, though rare enough, of women outside of Sparta who could read and write. Sappho, the poet from Lesbos, is perhaps the earliest and most famous example. Prolific during the late 7th and early 6th centuries, I've also seen inference to her having a school for teaching other girls the art of poetry and chorus. We also have the odd instance of high-born, elite Athenian women being literate, though these are few and far between. Certainly no other city-state formally educated its females as such. Uniquely amongst Greek women, there's every indication that Spartan girls were all taught to read and write. Borne out by the almost casual series of references to their literacy in the sources. In a saying by an unknown Spartan woman, recorded by Plutarch, it's said that upon hearing news that her son was behaving poorly abroad, that she wrote to him the following: "You've acquired a bad reputation. Either shake it off or cease to exist." There are also several other sayings preserved by the great biographer that indicate female literacy within the ruling class. Furthermore, Aristophanes, in his play called The Wasps, makes reference to a woman called Clitagora, a lyric poet known as the female Homer, who was a native of Sparta and of some renown at the time. From Herodotus, we have a story concerning a young Gorgo, the future wife of King Leonidas. At the time, her father Cleomenes ruled on the Argead throne, and he had recently deposed his antagonistic and opposing Eurypontid king, Demaratus. From exile in the Persian court, Demaratus sent a warning of the imminent Persian invasion back to his former home and people in the form of a blank wax tablet. Presumably this item was produced at a sitting of the Ephorate and Gerousia, but none of these worthies had any idea what it could mean, until Gorgo came forth and scraped off the wax, revealing to the men present the message etched on the timber beneath. Now this doesn't imply that Gorgo could read, but it shows that she was familiar with the implements for writing and canny enough to perceive the illusion. Although none of these examples are irrefutable, that women were literate and numerate makes sense if we think of their future utility as the managers of estates and households. With the menfolk often away on protracted campaigns, they needed to be able to take care of the day-to-day business at home, requiring them to effectively balance ledgers, record various levels of stores, and surely send correspondence for trade and the procurement of supplies. Remembering that with the capture of Messenia, much of the land owned by the Spartiates was at some distance from Lacedaemon, these duties required considerable attention and competence. I feel the view of the profligate Laconian was merely the casual observance of an outsider to Sparta, someone who never took the time or had the inclination to see the astute businesswoman beneath the extroverted exterior. Finally, from the 5th century, Spartan armies began spending more and more time in the field, further and further from the Peloponnese. This assuredly led to the need for personal correspondence between mothers and wives, and their sons and husbands. In Plutarch, there is evidence for such, and there is no reason to assume that there weren't at least competent levels of literacy amongst the ruling military class, their wives, mothers, sisters, and daughters. Athletically, it appears that girls were subjected to all the rigours of their counterparts save those of war games. Both, however, competed in wrestling, discus, and javelin throwing, and to my mind at least, these three activities were connected to the art of war itself. Either way, to Euripides' dismay and the scandal of Limpido in Aristophanes' work, Spartan females were an anomaly in ancient Greece for their well-known athleticism. As Lysistrata says to her Spartan opposite, "And how strong you seem! Why, you could surely strangle a bull." This is the Laconian preference for eugenics at play here. Lycurgus believed that fit mothers would deliver fit babies, and Sparta needed every one of those possible to survive the harsh existence laid out by his retra. It's unclear whether or not the sexes competed against each other, though I think it unlikely due to the differing aims of their training regimes, the one for war and the other for fitness. They definitely had ample opportunity to train and perform in front of each other, however, at the various religious festivals that called for such. We know that the Gymnopaedia, the festival of naked youths, had choral events for men, women, boys, and girls separate and in different age classes. The dress of women in Sparta was similar to other parts of Greece in daily activities. The chiton, a rectangular piece of fabric fastened at the shoulders and the waist, the Spartan variety allowed the thighs freedom of movement and gave the women of that city the reputation of thigh flashes. The peplos, a tube-like sewn piece of fabric that had slits up the sides in the Doric version, once again promoting the view mentioned before of showing off the thighs. The chemation served as a cloak or shawl and was worn in conjunction with other clothing. Not as voluminous as the toga, they were often heavily decorated and appear in many statues coming down from the classical period. Clothing aside, during exercise and certain religious festivals, Spartan men and women were either completely naked, lathered in olive oil, or at the very least scantily clad. This was purely for a pragmatic purpose, as our athletes in this day wear skin-hugging lycra. The Spartans realized too that clothing only got in the way, abandoning it for exercise and religious rites that required a full range of motion from a very early period in the archaic era. There is a bronze figurine dating from around 500 BCE found at Dodona, but believed to be showing an adolescent or young Spartan woman either in a pose of exercise or dance. Interestingly, it appears she is wearing a modified and short peplos that is barely knee length and draped over the left and under the right shoulder, exposing the right breast. It's the sort of outfit that could be easily pulled down to leave both arms completely free. It clearly relates freedom of movement and is iconic of the Sparta we read about in the sources. I'll put an image of it up on the website, as I will for a painting dating to the 19th century inspired by Plutarch's recording of Spartan boys and girls at competition. Although hardly contemporary, I believe this image, at least in its impression, is a very accurate depiction. Many of the exercises performed by women had an application for the hunt as well, a favourite pastime for the men, and one of the few excuses acceptable for missing the nightly communal dining required of citizens. Xenophon records that in his time some Spartan women engaged in hunting as well, and in that era, the men were constantly away at the many wars the burgeoning empire was fighting. To supplement the meagre Laconian fare, the wilderness surrounding Mount Taygetus was particularly well stocked with wildlife. There is, in that vein, also plenty of reason to believe that the Spartan girls were taught to ride at an early age, a skill essential for hunting, and also for managing far-flung estates. Traditionally, the ownership of horses fell to the cultural elite in ancient Greece, precisely the type of people at the upper echelons of Laconian society. From the mid-5th to the mid-4th century, a Spartan won almost every chariot event we have a record for in the ancient Olympic Games. Completely anomalously, though, on the roll of victors lies the names of several Spartan women. Kyniska, the sister of the powerful 4th century king Agesilaus, famously won the Tethrypon, or four-horse chariot event, at consecutive Olympic Games in 396 and 392 BCE. It should be noted that she herself did not drive the chariot, or indeed, due to Olympic rules banning women from attendance, see the races for herself. She did, however, train the horses, and had a statue of herself erected within the Olympic sanctuary with an epitaph carved on its base in her honour. We are fortunate that it is extant, and it reads as follows. My ancestors and brothers were kings of Sparta. I, Kyniska, victorious with a chariot of swift-footed horses, erected this statue. I declare that I am the only woman in all of Greece to have won this crown. After her death, Kyniska had a haroun, or a hero shrine, erected in her memory within Sparta. A clear sign of the esteem she was held in and designed to help other women emulate her victories. Something that occurred in the 368 BCE games, where another Spartan woman, Eurylionis, won the crown in the two-horse event. On top of literacy and physical exercise, the other facet of a girl's journey into Spartan womanhood was indoctrination into the local religion. It is perhaps the most well-documented part of their education, and we are fortunate to even have some archaic, albeit poetic material, still extant. Alcman the poet lived during the later stages of the 7th century, and like Tyrtaeus before him, is extremely important to our understanding of archaic Sparta. Whereas Tyrtaeus wrote war poems to bolster the martial spirit of the soldiers, Alcman wrote primarily choral hymns for the young women of the city. Highly fragmentary, much still can be garnered from his work. The most substantial fragment is known as the Parthenia, or Maiden Song. The 100 or so lines we have paint quite the lurid picture of young girls dancing naked beneath a moonlit sky and raising their voices in song at the behest of an older woman, the chorus master. I'll read a few lines now from a couple of different sections to give you a feel for their style. And I sing the light of Aido. I see her like the sun, which Aido is now, calling to shine as our witness. But the renowned choir leader does not allow me to praise or blame her at all. For she herself is conspicuous, as if one set among the herds of a strong horse with thundering hooves, a champion from dreams in a cave. And later, in the work, the following. However, because of Hagisa Hora, girls come to a lovely peace, for it is necessary to obey the trace horse and the driver. Of course, she is not a better singer than the sirens, for they are goddesses, and instead of their 11, we are only 10, and children who sing. The Aido and Hagisa Hora mentioned are believed to be the chorus leaders, and it's imagined that the maidens were in several groups, singing to the glory of their own chorus masters, in this case, the two women mentioned. Note the likening of Aido to a strong horse, another indication that Spartan girls were familiar with the animal and its spirit. And in other parts of the Parthenia, they espouse the traits of several different breeds. These choral events were strictly a female affair in essence, though at times they certainly performed before the larger citizen body, particularly during the festival to Artemis or Thea. That there was no male presence is obvious by the two records we have of the abduction of Spartan girls from just these sorts of festivities. Clearly their perpetrators knew they would be alone and vulnerable. Ironically enough, the very person the choruses were perhaps emulating as they danced naked along the Eurotas was Helen, who had a similar abduction by Theseus as she herself danced along that same river. Not just an initiation into the religious rites, it is also theorized that these activities were part of the homoerotic affections that seemed to be part of female society in Sparta. The following lines from another of Alcman's works seems to paint that type of picture. I will surely toss my blonde hair, with limb-loosening desire, and more meltingly than sleep and death she gazes towards. I might see if she would love me coming near, and take me by the soft hand. At once I would worship her. Pederasty amongst Spartan men and youths is an extremely well-documented occurrence, but putting aside the obvious sexual component at its heart, it was designed to acclimate the male youths to living communally with men for extended periods of time. It makes sense that the women, who for those same reasons would have been amongst themselves much of the time, had analogous rituals to socialise their younger companions. There is certainly precedent for this type of same-sex affection in the archaic Greek world, with significant portions of Sappho of Lesbos's surviving corpus speaking to her affection for female lovers. It should be noted, though, that there is no clear-cut evidence that there was anything more than platonic affection on display within the women of Sparta's communities. Another ritual, which is also referenced in the Lysistrata, was the competitive dance known as the Babesis. It was something that required extreme coordination and skill as participants jumped up to thump their heels into their buttocks repetitively. The victor was the one who could perform this act the most times in a row, and the record, according to Pollux, a 2nd century historian, was 1,000 leaps. Relating directly to Helen too was the festival held at the Platanista, an isle just off the banks of the Eurotas. A liminal place, half water and half land, in the shade of plane trees. It was here the girls almost certainly celebrated the life and beauty of their legendary ancestor, to whom they were the direct inheritors of man's wonder. To honour Helen, the virgins were left alone through the night. The dances they performed were surely heady, pulsating affairs designed to bring out every bit of their adolescent energy and tribute. It was a transitional ritual, and perhaps one of the last performed on their way to womanhood and marriage. I'll wrap up this first section of the podcast by first offering an apology. I truly wish there was more to say on the topic of raising Spartan girls. Without going off into pure rumour and sensationalism, though, there is little more that can be said concretely. Even some of what I've already said is hotly contested as to its veracity. For anyone interested in more information, I highly recommend Sarah Pomeroy's book Spartan Women, and also the work Bettany Hughes has done on Helen of Troy. The marriage rituals and lives of adult Spartan women are a topic for another episode, but we saw earlier how those women were perceived outside of Sparta. What I've said so far are some of the ways they got there, but far from being despised within their home city, they were esteemed and venerated in song and statue. Unlike their brothers, Spartan girls were given over to the care of their female networks from birth, and there is no reason to doubt that their first few years of life was not dissimilar to the boys. Presumably, from 7, their formal education began too, but was entirely the purview of the matriarchy, with maybe the casual oversight of the ephorate, who had as their primary duty the maintenance of traditional behaviours. They were taught to read and write, how to manage sometimes vast estates, and could handle a horse for transport and the hunt. Made to run, drill with rudimentary weaponry, and taught how to wrestle, these girls were formidable in their bearing. Being fed rations accordant with the boys resulted in the strength needed to birth and raise a race of warriors. Vocal in opinion, it is obvious they exerted great influence on the men around them with their precocity. Beneath this capable exterior, however, were deeply spiritual individuals whose close-knit community was held together not only by necessity, but by a common affection and love for their fellow woman. All of the important goddesses of Sparta were depicted in a warrior's garb, even Aphrodite. The women of Sparta personified these deities in every way and did them proud through dance and song. I'll finish this section with a little anecdote found in the works of the Roman satirist Juvenal. He recalls a story about a senator named Marcus Porfirius Sura. In it, the emperor Nero, who was clearly in fine form, summons a Spartan woman to court and has her wrestle the aforementioned senator. Likely purely apocryphal. If it happened, my money would be on the Spartan. Before we begin this second part, a quick word from a fellow podcaster.
Have you ever wondered why you have an Achilles heel? Or maybe why the days of the week are named the way that they are? Well, I'm here to tell you. Thoroughly Modern Mythology is a podcast that explores old mythology and the way that it impacts our everyday life. Every other week, we're going to have a podcast that will explore new myth, the way that it impacts the world around us every single day, and the way that mythology evolves. We're also going to get into some history, so I hope you enjoyed that class in high school. If you guys want to know more about how the world around you has been shaped by the oldest of stories, come on by. We're on Spotify and Anchor.fm. Just look for Thoroughly Modern Mythology. Thanks, guys. I hope we see you soon.
The show is only in its infancy, but has the makings of something really, really special. Do check it out. Looks like James and his co-host will be exploring all facets of mythology in a light-hearted fashion. They're currently working through Greek myth. It's difficult to say without a full account who had the more egregious upbringing, but due to greater popularity in the sources, it seems as though the boys had a particularly vicious time of it. The tests of their qualification into full enfranchisement began at birth and never truly ceased until they returned to the earth. Failure at any stage could see them denied or demoted from the citizenry. I like to think of their lives from the cradle to the grave as a series of hurdles, with final victory being an honourable death on the field, or one with honour after a long life of success. The very first obstacle, apart from the birth itself, came soon after, when the babe was presented before the Gerousia for examination. It's mentioned, in the life of Lycurgus, that mothers would wash their sons in wine prior to this, as it was believed the wine would help make them strong. The council checked over the newborn, and if any disabilities were detected, or worse still, if the little one cried out in fear, it was deemed unfit for progression into Spartan society and disposed of in accordance with tradition. It's an extremely popular story that has gained some traction not only in sensationalised depictions, but also in academia as well. The place of this supposed disposal was called the apotheti, which quite literally meant the place of discarding. There is a chasm at the base of a cliff on the slopes of Mount Taygetus that is believed to be the very spot the Spartans committed this foul deed, and sure enough, skeletal remains have been found within. They are, however, the bones of full-grown adults, and to date, no mass collections of infant remains have been found, but that doesn't mean that it didn't occur. I have personally seen the apotheti, prior to knowing that it held the remains of adults, and the mere sight of it filled me with dread. Regardless, it is clearly a place where misery in abundance occurred. My thoughts are that this story is just part of the Spartan mirage, one promulgated from within Laconia to the outside world. Exposing malformed or unwanted infants was nothing new to ancient Greece. Aristotle even advocated for it in that instance. The Spartans had nothing to gain by ridding themselves of male children who showed signs of fear when there was always a shortage of manpower in the city. Au contraire, they had much to gain by making other city-states believe they practiced infanticide. Just one more thing to add to their image of ferocity. So, despite much ink being spilt over the practice in Laconia, I for one don't buy it. Any examination of newborns by the Gerousia or the Ephorit was in my mind another tradition and simply a formality. Had the baby any obvious defects, it would have never made it to the place of trial. After this time, the child was raised amongst its immediate family until it turned 7. Until this time, boys and girls of Sparta were raised in much the same way as other Hellenes, but from this point, the upbringings diverged greatly. To go back to the Periclean funeral oration, Thucydides records the great Athenian visionary noting the distinction himself with the following passage. There is a great difference between us and our opponents in our educational systems. The Spartans, from their earliest boyhood, are submitted to the most laborious training and courage. We pass our lives without all these restrictions, and are yet just as ready to face the same dangers as they. Perhaps ready to face them, Pericles, but not overcome them, you might say. At any rate, within 2 years of that speech, Pericles would succumb to a plague afflicting Athens, and fortunately for him, not live to see his city's demise at the hands of the Spartans. He was right about one thing, though. The agoge was most laborious, and from 7, all Spartan boys were compelled to submit to it. The only exception were the kings, as it wouldn't do for a descendant of the Heraclidae to fail. The word itself, agoge, means quite literally the rearing, in the same sense you would use for cattle or sheep. Tying it into other pastoral terminologies used by the Dorians from an early period, but can be taken quite literally in this instance, as the boys were often treated like wild beasts. That being said, the Athenian historian Xenophon described it as the best system in all of Greece, and despite his reputation as a Lyconophile, or lover of all things Laconian, living as he was in Sparta, he was well placed to observe it. Furthermore, Xenophon really put his money where his mouth was, and placed his 2 sons in the agoge for good measure. Digression aside, from 7 the boys were taken from their family homes and placed in communal dormitories with others the same age. It would be the last time until their deaths that they would ever be even slightly free from their obligations to the laws of Sparta. They were further subdivided for the sake of control into groups of 60 boys called agelae, meaning herds. These groups were supervised by a magistrate known as the Paidonomos, the boy herder. It was also the beginning of the breaking down of the family unit into a life as part of the citizenry and the polis at large. Interestingly, the Greeks had no word for individual, not in the private sense, whereas the polis, or the city, was more thought of as an organism and the people within it just a part of the greater whole. Nowhere else was this more true than in Sparta. From the ages of 7 through to 12, they began to learn to read, write, and perform athletics in a similar fashion to the girls. Singing and dancing was also part of the curriculum at this stage. In the sources, it's implicit that failure at any of these tasks would result in expulsion from the agoge, and therefore from any chance of full suffrage. Punishments for poor performance were nasty and corporal, with the story of a boy having his fingers bitten by a teacher standing out. What was the crime? Not answering a question in a suitably laconic, that is, snappy, fashion. According to Lycurgus's wishes, the punishments meted out to the lads at the hands of their Paidonomos was often done before the elders, who would say nothing while the lashings or beatings occurred. But once finished, the venerable council would reprimand the boy herder for being too harsh, but also for being too mild and gentle. Xenophon even records that, and I quote, Lycurgus also assigned to the Paidonomos a staff of youths, provided with whips to chastise them when necessary, and the result is that modesty and obedience are inseparable companions at Sparta. The learning wasn't only formal during this period, it was also survivalistic in nature. Boys were required to go barefoot at all times and had only one homespun, rough tunic with which to cover themselves regardless of the weather. They even had to pluck reeds barehanded from the Eurotas and fashion bedding from such. Their rations were only the most meagre, and they were encouraged to steal food to supplement their meals. Naturally, they were severely castigated for being caught, but not for stealing per se, just for being bad thieves. There is a story of a boy who had stolen a fox, which is strange considering they are a wild creature, but upon being caught refused to reveal his theft. Hidden within his cloak, the creature gnawed through the boy's entrails, and he collapsed dead at the feet of his accuser. From 12, if you can believe it, the harshness of the agoge really ramped up. With their formal, theoretical education now apparently complete, the boys were now subjected to a quasi-military-like barracks life where the strictest of discipline was enforced. I'm not sure it counts as any reprieve, but at this stage they were given one cloak to accompany the solitary tunic they had for clothing. Let's hope they were thankful for small mercies. Most likely up until this point, the boys were under the direct control of their respected Paidonomos. But now socialization into the greater male citizenry began, and they were under constant surveillance by everyone in the community. As part of the Lycurgan reforms, and to also further break down the sense of individuality, it was dictated that if ever the Paidonomos was away, any male citizen at any time had the right to punish the young adolescents for any perceived transgression. They would grow to know that there was nowhere to hide from the laws of Sparta. It is imagined that this is when the truly competitive nature of their training began, both in the art of war, but also in song. On top of continual testing, every age group had to perform some type of final testing to progress to the next age grade. This occurred at the end of every year, as the Spartans measured it, possibly from Gymnopaedia to the next. The festival of the Dia Mastagosis, which we have looked at before, was quite likely one such test and harkens back to the boys' youthful escapades in search of food. It involved trying to steal blocks of cheese from the altar of Artemis or Thea, whilst at the same time trying to avoid being scourged by older boys with ready whips. Military exercise was the order of the day, as Spartans were forbidden by the Lycurgan doctrine to practice any art other than war. Weapons training, hand-to-hand combat, formation drilling, strength and conditioning, and other such activities would have occupied the lads from sunup to sundown, day in and day out. They were encouraged by their elders to resolve disputes with physical violence, and only the losers were reprimanded for unmanliness. Pragmatically, the practice of song and dance continued from this point and would do so throughout the Spartiates' lives as these things had a direct correlation to battle. The synchronicity required for hoplite warfare was best understood through rhythm and beat, and the youths were given opportunity to compete against older age groups at the Gymnopaedia in particular. This festival had three male age groups, one for boys, one for young men, and another for older men. Plutarch records some of the verses sung, which I'll relate now. First the old man sang, "We once did deeds of prowess, and were strong young men." Then the young men would chant back, "We are so now, and if you wish, behold and see." And finally the boys would sing, "We shall be some time mightier men by far than both." At 12 too began the practice of compulsory paederasty, or paederastia. Coming from the Greek word for boy, pais, and the word for lover, erastis, it was a common practice in one form or another in other parts of Hellas, but the Spartans, like everything else, governed it with a strict code. The erastis, or senior partner, came from the youngest adult male class, known as the erenes, and was generally not married. Having been removed from the family home from a young age, the overall aim of the erastis was to act as a surrogate father figure and help with the boy's assimilation into the all-male warrior society. Certainly, as inferred by the title, paederastia, sex was a part of the relationship, but it most definitely wasn't the primary nor fundamental function of it. Xenophon, who as I've mentioned had his own sons in the agoge, goes to great pains to stress that point in his work, saying, "If it was clear that the attraction lay in the boy's outward beauty, rather than his virtues, then the relationship was to be banned and labelled an abomination." The erenes, already elected to the communal mess, assuredly allowed the younger partner to accompany them to the dining halls. Here they were asked all manner of questions by the other men and judged by the brevity and accuracy of their answers. In some instances, the lads may even have been required to accompany their senior partner on campaign and help with the managing of estates to further their education of those matters in lieu of a paternal relationship. The erastis was responsible for all cultural and social aspects outside of the military doctrine and were also held to account for any lack of manliness in the younger partners. Plutarch reports that during one of the regular and grueling physical contests, a youth cried out in pain, a grave mistake that resulted in his older partner's punishment rather than his own. It was deemed that the erenes hadn't instilled the correct amount of kateria, or endurance, in his charge. The origins of paederasty within Sparta are impossible to divine, and we are left only with mostly 4th century and later accounts as to its practice. I think it worthy to delve a little into a more general study of ethnography in other places to tease out what are some stark similarities in other, relatively modern Stone Age cultures. The first example I'd like to describe is from the Aboriginal people, a collective name for the many varied indigenous peoples of my home country, Australia. Specifically in this case, the Arrente people. Their traditional lands were in the very centre of this sunburnt land, covering some 120,000 square kilometres. According to the observations of a German missionary during the 19th century, the practice of this people was to allocate a youth of 12 to 14 to a young unmarried man for the purposes of cohabitation. This state of affairs could last for several years until the senior partner married a woman and the paederastic relationship was naturally dissolved. The ages involved in these unions are very similar to that practiced in Sparta, though I can't find any evidence of their purpose within Arrente society. The most strikingly analogous occurrence I have found comes from the Papuan province of Indonesia and involves the Marind Anem people. Before Christian intervention during the 20th century, they practiced headhunting, ritualized warfare, homosexuality, along with a form of polyandry. Salient to our Spartans was the Marind's custom of dividing boys into age groups and enforcing elaborate rites of progression from one group to the next. They were segregated from their families between the ages of 5 and 8, and with the onset of puberty, were put under the care of a surrogate father. Sex was indeed a part of their relationship, but the senior partner is considered to be the youngest guide through the varying stages of progression into manhood, and the boy remained under his care until marriage. Even after, the relationship continues, and in this also, the Marind Anem people share something else in common with the Lacedaemonians. Tantalizing as it is, we can't simply substitute this culture for that of our subjects, but I believe this glance at ethnography helps illuminate the practice of paederasty within the archaic realm of Sparta, of which we have no surviving evidence. Separated as ancient Greece is from the traditional cultures of our own era by thousands of years, these examples highlight how a particular kind of society might develop. It's obvious by Xenophon's time, in the classical era, that this facet of the agoge was much more than a purely sexual pursuit. So much so, that many 18th and 19th century scholars refused to admit, or simply could not see, that intercourse had any place within these relationships. The social mores of that era also played a part in their denial or obfuscation of this unsavoury practice. In leaving the topic here, I would say finally that an immature agoge began to be formulated by the end of the Second Messenian War as part of the militarisation of Spartan society, and at least an early structure of pederasty came into being sooner rather than later. There are good accounts of some of the more famous pederastic relationships, but we'll come back to those as the timeline progresses into the earlier 4th century BCE. However, only Zeus knows when I'll get there. I hope you aren't in a hurry. If a boy managed to survive until he turned 18, and Xenophon in his Anabasis attests to the perils of the agoge, then their formal education, as it were, was considered finished. One final institutionalized hurdle remained towards full citizenship, that of being voted into one of the communal mess halls. This isn't the place to go into the structure of the syssitia, as they were called. Comprising of 15 men, acceptance into one was essential to become one of the homoioi. Presumably during the years-long agoge, sitting members had many opportunities to observe future candidates and their prowess, so in some cases it may have been a foregone conclusion. But that we know that a failed candidature allowed for another final attempt a year later tells us that entry was not always guaranteed. Unfortunately for those young men not accepted, all the years of pain, hunger, loneliness and exposure resulted in their permanent relegation to the class of the hippomionis, the inferiors. A cruel fate, and I can scarcely imagine the degree of disappointment and exclusion you would feel. The final thing we'll be looking at for the progression of males through Spartan society, and for that matter the episode today, will be the years from 18 to 20. These years, for lack of a better term, can be considered a type of national service, whereby, despite not yet being a fully fledged member of the citizenry, these now young men served in the junior ranks of the army. A time for the homoioi to fully observe the potential of future comrades in action and see if they had what it took to withstand the press and murder of phalanx-styled warfare. Apart from that fact, little is known about this period and the types of services rendered to the state during it, but one can easily imagine the types of duties allocated to the, relatively speaking, boys of the camp. I'm picturing latrine duties, shoveling dung, sharpening swords, collecting firewood, and help in preparing meals. A real apprenticeship of the fighting unit. In combat, it could have even been their original Pythonomos who led them, but it's all conjecture, and a massive black hole to join the other black holes in what we don't know about the Lacedaemonians. What we do know for sure is that some of the especially outstanding young men were selected, again we know not how, for enrolment in the Spartan secret service, or the Crypteia. Now, we looked at this institution in our last episode on Spartan government and learnt that the Cryptoi were under the direct control of the Ephoric Council, a bureau of terror that could be unleashed at a moment's notice to rain misery upon the enslaved helots. With possible election to the communal messes on the line, the teenagers who made up the Cryptoia's numbers were assuredly keen to impress their masters. We should be careful to note that not all helots were created equal. I will deal completely with the class's indenture in the future, but for now, they were divided culturally and geographically into two groups, the Laconian and the Messenian. The former were under the Spartan heel from a very early time, well before the expansion outside of Laconia, whilst the latter obviously only came into the fold following the successful completion of the First Messenian War. The first group seemed to be remarkably compliant, and we have only one instance during their 500-year enslavement of any insurrection. The Messenians, however, never forgot their once proud bearing and needed extra incentive in the form of fear to remain obedient. In that land, the Spartans had, as the old saying goes, a wolf by the throat. This group were the main target of the Cryptoi. The inception of the Cryptia is recorded according to Aristotle as being yet another creation of Lycurgus. Plutarch, rightly I think, debunks that in his Life of the Lawgiver by suggesting that it didn't suit the beneficent and altruistic aims of his subject. Moreover, if there ever was a Lycurgus within the early 8th century, he was unlikely to have had any helots to subject. The biographer suggests this secret service brigade came into being after the great earthquake of 464 BCE and the subsequent revolt of the helots. Conceivably, it might have ramped up its activities in the wake of the near cataclysmic event, but I think it likely to have come into being sometime after the Second Messenian War, which was more of a full-scale revolt, as part of the greater reforms sweeping Laconia at the time. The Spartans were in the habit of keeping the helots in an as abject state as possible and often took brutal steps in the process. Thucydides records that in the year 425, during the Peloponnesian War, the Homoioi sent forth a proclamation to the helots who had been assisting them in the war to present 2,000 of their number who had best served Sparta. Lured with potential freedom, the slaves had garlands placed on their heads and went around the temples in an apparent rite of freedom. Only, the Spartans killed them to a man. In a similar, though smaller scale, did the Crypteia operate. Rogue terrorists who lived out in the countryside of Messenia, mostly for extended periods of time. Remembering that from early in the Agoge, the boys had been taught to live off the land and take what they needed. They selected the bravest, the strongest, and those most likely deemed dissidents for summary execution. They promoted a culture of fear within the enslaved class. The state of affairs was so terrible, it prompted a 5th century Athenian politician to say that, and I quote, "There is nothing to match the freedom of the free man in Sparta, or the slavery of the slave." With the Ephorate making a yearly declaration of war against the helots, the Cryptoi were free to do as they deemed necessary in whatever capricious fashion they chose. As mentioned previously, we have records of some Cryptaean members being elevated to officer status after service, so they had every reason to perform their foul duties to the utmost. But more on that another time. To summarise, for better or for worse, there was this rigorous and compulsory training, state-sponsored as it was, that gave the Spartans the upper hand on the battlefield. By 480 BCE, it was a well-oiled machine producing just the types of warriors Greece needed to galvanise their resistance to the inexorable forces of Xerxes, first at Thermopylae, and later at Plataea. It was, in my mind, the great equaliser, and barring the kings, of course, gave every prospective citizen an equal opportunity at the ultimate prize, homoioi status. Cruel in so many ways, the world was equally cruel, and more so the one within Laconia. To dominate the helots and the Peloponnese regionally, Sparta needed obedient, compliant, and resilient young men to fill the ranks of the assembly and the army. The Agoge was the vehicle that provided them. I do hope you all enjoyed this episode. It was a privilege, as always, to have your company, and apologies if my voice is a little croaky. Football season has recently begun here in Australia, the rugby league variety, and I've had a few late nights yelling my advice to the referee on the television screen, and enjoying a few beverages. Up next, I have a real treat for you and a step away from the usual format. What's that, I hear you say? Please don't go back to the Bronze Age or mythology. I wouldn't dream of it. What I will be doing is interviewing Professor Paul Bardunius from the Florida Atlantic University, co-author of the book Hoplites at War. I can't wait, not just because I won't have to spend a month writing a script, but mostly because you, my friends, will actually get to hear from a genuine scholar. Paul is an expert on Greek warfare from the archaic through to the classical period and a bona fide Spartan, as his great-grandfather hailed from Sparta. Both of these qualities make him eminently qualified to come on the show, and I think it will be informative and a lot of fun. So please, dear listeners, join me on Sunday, April the 11th, episode 23, Hoplites and the Spartan War Machine, where we will dive right into warfare and its style in the period. Until then, take good care and speak soon. You can find me on Twitter at Spartan_history and on Facebook too at Spartan History Podcast. If you like this episode and are keen to hear more, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your pods from, and leave a review. See you next time.